Foy Short, A Life in Southern Africa. Chapter 6, Return to the States, 1995. Church Family in Nashville. Foy and Margaret returned to Nashville and settled into their new home in White House, about 20 miles north of Nashville. He wrote in October of 1995, "Our personal effects have arrived. Now to erect shelves for all my books, then unpack and sort." They began to worship regularly with the Kemper Heights congregation. It formed when members of the old Joseph Avenue Church in Nashville decided to leave the deteriorating neighborhood where their building was located to form the new congregation. Ellen and David Bays attended the congregation in the 1970s, and when Foy and Margaret's daughter Catherine visited her sister there, she met her future husband, Roger Lee Smith. So, it was natural for Foy and Margaret to worship at Kemper Heights with their daughter and son-in-law. Soon, they became close to the brethren there, and eventually Foy was made an elder in the congregation with Bill Jones, James Perry, Vernon Allen, and Jim Young. Publications work. The dearth of Bible study aid in the Ascendabili language was constantly on Foy's mind when he worked with people of that tribe. A translation of the New Testament became available in the dialect only shortly after Foy began his work among the Amandabeli in 1947. The Old Testament translation appeared first in the early 1970s. Until that time, those who spoke Isindebele had to do the best they could to examine the Old Testament scriptures in the Zulu language, which, though related to Isindebele, is not exactly the same. Foy began to dream of a concordance in the Isindebele language when he visited a small congregation in a rural part of Zimbabwe, and an evangelist asked him where to find a passage of scripture. Foy said, he had been reading his Bible for months trying to find this verse. He knew it was there. I took my concordance and found it right away. From that time, Foy determined that if he ever found the time, he needed to work up a Bible concordance in the Isindebele language. When thinking of returning to the States, he realized that there he would have the time for that tedious project, as well as commentaries and other needed materials. All of Foy's supporting congregations, except for one, decided to continue to support him in his publication endeavors, and after settling in, he began the monotonous work. From the beginning, a number of complications accompanied the concordance project. First, he had to obtain permission from the Bible Society. Then, he began the long process of scanning every page of the Bible in the Isindebele language. However, there were snags when the OCR program tried to turn the foreign words from the scanned material into readable text that Foy could use with a word program. The program was designed for English and European languages and balked at reproducing the African words in their original form. The fact that so many proper names in the language began with lowercase prefixes threw the program completely off, especially encountering names from the Old Testament. Foy's son Harold was head of the Computers for Teaching the Humanities Department of King's College in London. He was highly proficient in working with software programs for printing applications and was an invaluable aid to his father in this frustrating process, spending long hours on the project in spite of having just suffered a serious automobile accident. Foy's son Jim said, quote, "In a very real sense, the concordance should be seen as the joint effort of Harold and my dad, with a little help here and there from others. Without either one, it simply would not have happened. When my dad first had the idea, he spoke to Harold about it. Harold was the one who had the technical expertise to know how it could be done. My dad had the Bible knowledge and understanding of the Isindebele language and culture that was essential to the task, and I know of no one else who had both of these attributes like he did. For both Harold and my dad, it was a way to work together to the benefit of the Lord's work in Zimbabwe, which was deeply meaningful to both of them. My dad spoke to Harold about his dream of a concordance, and Harold was the one who made the plan begin to happen. Close quote. After a whole year, the scanning project was finally completed, and Foy began to sort out the different categories and words that would comprise the concordance. He wrote in May of 2002, quote, "The mysteries of the concordance software program are being unraveled. I've made an experimental concordance for Joshua and Judges. They are too detailed, listing every word. On that basis, a concordance of the entire Bible would have to be well over 1,000 pages. It would be too bulky to be useful and too expensive to print. So now I must learn how to set parameters that will limit the choice of words to be included." Close quote. Foyt wanted his published material to be reviewed by brethren who spoke the language as natives, so that they could make suggestions about phrasing and word choice. Sometimes he would send the material to Mountbatten Brewer, and sometimes he would take it with him on his trips back to Zimbabwe to review with his brethren there. Foy spent most of his time during the 2006 trip to Zimbabwe putting the finishing touches on the concordance with four brethren who were well-versed in the Ascendabelle language: Newman Gumbo, Mountbatten Brewer, Enoch Newbing, and Matando Mafosa. Finally, in late 2006, the concordance was finished, and Foy began to distribute it to some, though the large-scale printing was not completed until 2011. Foy told Ken Green that the concordance of 378 pages, as he put it, contains 4,062 word stems and 18,800 references. An index of personal names includes 404 persons with 1,543 references. An index of place names has 202 places with 867 references. Though Harold and Foy did the lion's share of the work on the project, other family members made important contributions. Foy also wrote commentaries for those who spoke the Ascendabelle language. He completed some while in Zimbabwe and had more time to work on them when he arrived in the States in 1995. He has written commentaries on Matthew, Luke, Acts, Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, and Ezekiel. He wrote in April of 2003 about his commentary on Galatians. Quote, "When we get to Zimbabwe, I can get help to complete it. I plan to have 1,000 copies printed for use in the classes and for distribution among the churches. Adventism is very strong, and most denominations have no idea of the significance of the difference between the Old and New Testaments. I prepared and used a commentary on Romans last year. It was enthusiastically received." Close quotes. Foy wrote the commentaries in English and had them translated into Ascendabelle in Bulawayo. The translators then sent all but the last two back to him for revision before their final publication. Relief for needy saints. Persistent drought, along with government mismanagement, produced increasing hardship and famine in Zimbabwe. The crisis produced a mass exodus of Zimbabweans to neighboring countries, especially South Africa, while those who stayed scrambled to find anything to eat. With the collapse of the Zimbabwean economy and resulting hyperinflation came the inevitable dark humor. Foy said that one joke that made the rounds was about a man who came down a path with a wheelbarrow full of money. He just left it for a minute, and when he came back, someone had left all the money in a heap and stolen the wheelbarrow. The jokes were necessary as a coping mechanism when facing the devastating effects of the famine. Foy quoted the BBC News in 2003, "Elderly people are starving to death, while children have died of poisoning after eating the wrong leaves as a substitute for food." Foy and Margaret worked to encourage American brethren to send relief to the needy saints beginning in 1982. While doing so, they were careful to avoid setting up anything like a church-supported human agency to do the work, encouraging instead the use of messengers to carry the relief directly to the needy congregations. They focused on helping the needy around Bulawayo. Several men, such as Newman Gumbo, Dennis Clark, Telly Moyo, and Big Boy Dube, were especially reliable as messengers to get the aid to needy brethren. The messengers protected their reputations by having each church have three signatories to sign a receipt for what was received, and thus were able to account for all the relief that was sent through them. Others from South Africa, especially Leslie Maydell and David Beckley, worked to raise relief for brethren in the South, where the drought was even more severe. Eventually, Maydell and Beckley took over most of the relief that Foy was undertaking. Others, like Mike Divas, worked diligently to find ways to alleviate the suffering of the brethren. As could be expected when such a large need was being met, there were some mix-ups and disagreements among Americans about shipments, currency exchange, and other nuts and bolt challenges of distributing relief. Foy wrote a number of letters in the year 2000 to try to clear up what he felt to be misunderstandings. Margaret emphasized that government mismanagement exacerbated the food crisis caused by the recurring droughts, especially after 2000. In February of that year, a referendum was held on a new constitution that would have given Mugabe sweeping powers. The people rejected the new constitution, and Mugabe immediately started taking over the productive, primarily white-owned farms, which were mainly in the less drought-prone areas. In some cases, farmers were murdered. Mugabe claimed that this land would be distributed to the peasants since the settlers had supposedly stolen it from them. Those he called settlers were second and third generation Zimbabweans who had bought the land and had worked hard to develop it. The land was given to his cronies who knew nothing about farming. Therefore, very little, if anything, was produced on what used to be productive land, and expensive farm machinery was left to rust away. The food shortage became even more severe. However, good brethren from a number of places supplied food to the brethren, who were therefore able to survive. Dealing with problems associated with age. Foy had hip replacement surgery in 1997. A year later, he began to have some symptoms of more heart problems, and Margaret insisted on taking him to the hospital, where doctors determined to give him a second bypass operation. However, Foy recuperated well from it and continued to work on his printing projects and make his annual trips to Zimbabwe. A second scare occurred in 2004 when doctors discovered a cancerous polyp in Foy's colon. However, after an operation and treatment, Foy seemed to be cancer-free. Though he had helped fill in preaching at Kemper Heights for Ken Green when he first came to Nashville, his health problems led to a reduction in that responsibility. When he improved, Ken Green asked him if he thought he could fill in again. Foy told him he thought he could preach for 20 minutes. When Green heard that, he retracted the offer, saying, "If you did that, they would want to hire you." Trips back to Zimbabwe. Foy returned every year to Zimbabwe from the time he left in 1995 until 2007, except for 2004 when he had had an operation for colon cancer. For each trip, he had his close friend Newman Gumbo work up a schedule to make the maximum use of his time. Usually, he would visit three congregations in the countryside and spend the weekends in Bulawayo conducting organized Bible studies on various topics. An exception to the schedule was made in 2006 when, as noted earlier, Foy spent all his time reviewing the Isindebele Bible Concordance Project with his helpers. Foy wrote in 1996, quote, "Reports concerning the Lord's work in Zimbabwe continue to be encouraging. Margaret and I are looking forward to spending some time with the Christians there in August and September. The Embry Hills Church in Atlanta has undertaken to pay for our return airfare expenses to $3,498, for which we are grateful. That takes care of the major travel expense." Close quote. He wrote in 2003, "Embry Hills Church, Atlanta, Georgia, has paid for the air tickets for our trip to Zimbabwe, assistance they have given every year beginning with 1996. Foy summed up his trip in 1999. "From August the 6th through September the 5th, he, quote, preached for 21 churches, conducted 17 Bible classes, and had 15 discussions with individuals. This required driving 2,536 miles, much of it over very rough trails." Close quote. Then, after Margaret, David, and Ellen Bays met him in Bulawayo on September the 5th, they traveled 2,881 more miles and visited 28 more congregations, teaching a combined total of 76 Bible classes and sermons. Foy mentioned three things that impressed him after his trip to Zimbabwe in 2002. First, the barren desolation caused by the drought. Second, the growth and vigor among the Christians. And third, the diligence of Patty and Sandy Kendallball and how gladly they were received among the brethren. Foy said of the Kendallballs, "Seldom can more diligent, zealous, and faithful Christians be found. They are truly giving themselves to God's work. I felt constrained to warn them of the need to get adequate rest lest they ruin their health." He described some of the special studies conducted among the brethren in 2002. Quote, "Our first series of Bible studies were held at a central point about 120 miles south of Bulawayo at a little center called Guyu. In true African fashion, not all those attending arrived in time for the first day's classes, but there were eventually over 200 who studied with us. The women's classes were taught by Margaret, Linda Maydell, Sarah Calvert, and Sandy Kendallball. Les Maydell and I taught the men's classes. Most of the time, Patty was busy with Brother Gumbo delivering cornmeal to the churches in need. Our aim was to have classes 8 hours a day for 4 days. Due to travel problems, we didn't quite achieve the full 8 hours per day." Close quote. The efforts of African brethren to attend such Bible study sessions always impressed Foy. He said, "Many of those people do not have the money for bus tickets on very unpredictable bus lines. They either have to walk or travel by donkey or ox cart. I remember vividly a woman who had lost one of her legs, yet walked with crutches 12 miles to attend Bible classes at the Nzwezi Church." Jim Short recalled receiving a similar lesson on one of his own visits. Quote, "I remember a lesson in humility from my visit in 2006. I was feeling a little proud of myself for getting up at 5 a.m. on a Saturday morning to get ready to leave at 6 a.m. and drive 3 hours to teach for 5 hours or so in West Nicholson. Then when I got there, I met a group of about seven people who had arisen at 2 a.m. to walk for 7 hours to get to the meeting place. Close quote. Foy usually used translators when teaching in Ascendabelle, even though he knew the language. Margaret said, "Translators have always been a bit nervous translating for him because he knew what they were saying. Sometimes he would stop and tell them, 'No, this word's better.'" Stanley Sitoli was one of the young translators who Foy would sometimes correct. He told Ellen Bays in 2010 that Foy's suggestions made him a better translator and gave him a better understanding of the scriptures. Stanley, whose father is an elder at the Magwegwe congregation in Bulawayo, became an excellent translator, according to Patty Kennebaugh. He helped with the final revisions on the Bible Concordance. When not in rural areas, Foy stayed with Dennis and Ann Clark in Bulawayo until Dennis Clark passed away. Then he stayed with the George Edes, who had bought their home in Bulawayo when they left in 1995. He always worked closely with Mountbatten Brewer, who had started a new congregation in Bulawayo. In spite of the economic crisis and political instability, the Hillside Congregation in English and Queen's Park Congregation in Ascendabelle continued their work in Bulawayo along with five other congregations that worshipped in the Ascendabelle language. Several American evangelists accompanied Foy on his travels, including Gary Sandusky and Ken Green. Green said that he accompanied Foy about five times. As he observed Foy on his trips, Green was impressed with Foy's kind approach to teaching. He said, "He often taught by raising questions, just as the Lord did. He's an extremely liberal fellow in the sense of being open-minded and charitable and generous with those he has an issue with. He tries to get across his point of view softly. As a matter of fact, he has shown a number of times that he is willing to change." Gary Sandusky told in a sermon of an all-night drive with Foy from Bulawayo to South Africa. When they started off, Foy began to settle into his seat and told Sandusky to drive the whole way while he slept. Somewhat perturbed, Sandusky said, "I don't know the roads to South Africa. You're going to have to stay awake and help me navigate." Foy responded calmly, "Down here we have the Southern Cross constellation." He pointed out the formation of stars in the southern sky to Sandusky and said, "When you come to an intersection, just take the road that goes towards the cross, and that will get us to our destination." Sandusky made a spiritual application of Foy's words to the effect that when we come to a crossroads in our lives, we should always proceed in the direction of the cross. Ken Green recalled an occasion when he was driving with Foy over a rough stretch of road near the border between Zimbabwe and South Africa. Their rental car had badly adjusted headlights and evidently appeared to oncoming drivers to be on high beam. They responded by turning on their high beams, almost blinding Green, who was already having enough of a challenge by having to drive on the left side of the road. After a while, Foy told Green, "Ken, I admire your driving and how you keep the car on the road with these bright lights shining in your eyes." Green responded, "Foy, when I can't see, I just close my eyes and pray." That story became a favorite of Foy's. Though Foy was thrilled at the hundreds of people who attended the special Bible studies he conducted when visiting his homeland and at seeing new generations of children focusing upon the Word, the general trend in Africa was to follow the moral decline of the West. He said in an oral report, quote, "Things are changing in Africa all over. The influence of Western civilization, if you can call it that, is taking root among them. It's the bad habits that are taking place first and that are most sought after. Where they used to see courtesy and politeness towards elders, the young people are learning that it doesn't matter. Foy mentioned in 2002 his appreciation for the concern many had for his safety when traveling. However, he reassured readers of his report that he was discreet about avoiding visits to problem areas. Then he reminded his readers about the dangers of parts of Nashville and the high-speed highways. He concluded, "Tell you what, we will pray for your safety in this country while you pray for ours in Zimbabwe." Travel into Zimbabwe grew even more dangerous after Foy stopped traveling to the country. Warren Schultz, a faithful Christian from South Africa, was brutally attacked when traveling to the country to preach in March of 2010 and was thankful to be released alive by his assailants. Visits to Rhodesia by other American evangelists. During Foy's latter years in Africa and after his return to the States, a number of American evangelists began to travel into Zimbabwe. Foy felt that most of them encouraged the brethren and did good work. However, he strongly disagreed with a few who began to recommend Zimbabwean preachers for American salaries. Besides discouraging sacrifice among Zimbabwean brethren to help their own evangelists, Foy felt that American support, quote, "fosters an attitude of looking to people overseas rather than looking to God and breeds jealousy," close quote. He felt that Americans often don't understand the harmful effects caused by American dollars. Quote, "Americans have no way of understanding how little it takes by our standards to be rich by their standards. I have known some good preachers to become discouraged because they were not receiving outside support while others were. I must not be a good preacher because I was not chosen to be supported," is the response I have heard before. Close quote. On one occasion, Foy remarked, "I don't understand how Americans who love their independence so much seem determined to create dependency among others." In 2006, Foy summed up his feelings about changing attitudes that accompanied American salaries. Quote, "There are over 100 congregations in the southwest part of Zimbabwe. This could not have been achieved without the hard work and faithful teaching of the African preachers living and working within their own economy. I see this changing now, and it concerns me deeply." Close quote. David Beckley, whom Foy highly respected, wrote a detailed article about the harm caused by American support for those Zimbabwean preachers that were relatively untaught. He lamented, quote, "When an American preacher or elder or any Christian comes to preach or teach in Africa for short periods of time, wisdom dictates that he listen to those who have been working in Africa with African brethren for a number of years." Close quote. However, Foy's advice about American support for Zimbabwean preachers and that of other veterans of the African work like Ray Votaw, Gene Tope, Paul Williams, and David Beckley was sometimes ignored. Beckley said, "Those of us who have to work with these men to help sort out the resultant problems see the reality that visiting Americans only glance at and then seemingly dismiss or forget." David Maxson visited a country where many native evangelists were heavily supported by American churches when he was in his early 20s. Then he visited Zimbabwe in August of 2010 with Joe Greer. He said that there was a tremendous difference between the evangelist in the two places. Conversations with preachers like Enoch Nyube, Newman Gumbo, and others in Zimbabwe were deep and satisfying, dealing with spiritual needs and biblical analysis, whereas preachers in the first country fawned over him, dropping hints for American dollars. He felt very uncomfortable with preachers in the first country who were seeking dollars, but was greatly encouraged by the maturity and depth of those in Zimbabwe. Foy received criticism from some who thought he was inconsistent in his position about American salaries for African evangelists, because on one occasion he recommended temporary part-time support for a respected Zimbabwean evangelist. However, he and Margaret felt that the temporary nature of the recommended support at a critical time, and the fact that it was an exception, meant that it didn't violate Foy's generally held views. Foy was also courteously challenged by friends who respected his work, but who felt that he shouldn't allow congregations to help him by sending money to a work fund. Time with family. After returning to the States, Foy and Margaret enjoyed more time with their children and grandchildren. Margaret wrote about a trip to visit Ellen and Dave in Virginia in 1998, and seeing their new great-grandchild, Marissa Ellen. After Jim arrived from California, the whole crew traveled up Chesapeake Bay to Chincoteague Island and then to Washington, D.C. She mentioned a shop in Hampton, Virginia, that specialized in British merchandise where she was able to buy items that she enjoyed in Zimbabwe. She mentioned cream crackers, Marie and lemon cream, lemon curd, Marmite, Bovril, anchovette, Lyle's golden syrup, Dettol, etc. Her biggest find, however, was a Morphy Richards automatic kettle made for American Current. Foy reported on his 65th anniversary celebration with Margaret in 2009. He said, "One of the most enjoyable periods was when we celebrated our 65th wedding anniversary on the 23rd and had all our children from London, California, Virginia, and Tennessee with us for a few days. We had a great time just being together and an enjoyable dinner at Catfish Inn in Springfield, a favorite place with all of us." Trips by David and Ellen Bays. Foy followed the travels of his son-in-law David Bays and daughter Ellen to Zimbabwe with particular interest. Ellen had visited Africa three times since moving away in the mid-1960s. Then, in 1995, she took her husband David with her for the first time and stayed a few extra weeks after his departure to help her parents with packing for their departure. Before her parents left for the States, Ellen and her friend Gail Hadfield Duchaman traveled to the mission stations of Zambia to see the areas where her grandparents worked in the 1920s and again in the 1950s and early 1960s. Roy Merritt, son of pioneer preacher Dow Merritt, was in charge of Namuyanga Mission in 1895 and showed Ellen and Gail around. Ellen's initial impression was that the place had shrunk. The mission wasn't as big as it used to be. She said it looked like a time warp. You see things and they look familiar, but they're so little. Everything looked run down and different. Ellen wondered what had happened to Alvin Hobby's telescope that she remembered from the 1950s. Roy Merritt told her that the ever-present termites got into the house and he had to pull it down. Other buildings were used for different purposes, including the dorm for the boys and the Eureka School. She was glad that the church building that her grandfather, W.N. Short, built was still there. According to Roy Merritt, its longevity was due in great part to its granite foundation that Short learned to make from his association with the old pioneer, John Sheriff. Since their trip in 1995, Ellen and Dave have traveled about once every 2 years to Zimbabwe, visiting brethren in various parts of the country. When in the cities, she and David have stayed with her friends such as Gail Hadfield Duchaman, George and Jimmy Eady, her cousin, Jeannie and Ed Duthie, or George and Pauline O'Donnell. When in the country, she and David stayed in tents or drove back to the nearest town to stay with friends or in a hotel. In 2004, as was her custom, she went through South Africa visiting the Leslie Maydells and her old college friends, Joanne Beckley and her husband David, who were always a help to her. She said, "The Maydells have the car we use in Zimbabwe, and Joanne and David store our camping equipment. Both print out our lessons for us and provide other assistance as needed, plus a place to stay as we travel through South Africa and transportation to and from Johannesburg Airport." She placed pictures of her trip in 2004 on her Facebook page. She did the same after a trip in 2010. Foy felt that his son-in-law, David Bayes, adapted quickly to preaching among the Africans. Quote, "He has quickly come to understand their limited knowledge of American idioms and illustrations, relating his lessons to their way of thinking and lifestyle." Close quote. Conclusion. Foy's youngest brother, Bill, passed away in 2009. Foy wrote a heartfelt tribute about him in his monthly report. Quote, "We are grieving the death of my younger brother, Bill. He died suddenly last Friday from a heart attack. While they were checking his heart, the aorta ruptured and he died soon after that. He had been a professor of languages at McMurray University in Abilene, Texas for many years. He had an outstanding record of service to the church, the university, the community, and his many students. His children have been overwhelmed to find all the honors and awards he has received, which he never displayed. His family always came first, before any of these groups he served so well. He taught his students so much more than languages." Bill was only 66, 22 years younger than I, so we didn't grow up together. However, we watched him grow up with our children in the Rhodesias. He and Harold were only 2 years apart and had some great times together. He was more like a cousin to our children. Close quotes. In 2011, Foy and Margaret continue to work in the Lord's service in White House, Tennessee, though Foy is slowing down considerably because of his advancing age. He still spends a good portion of his days in the office working on various projects in the Assiniboine language. He wrote at the end of 2009, "I am getting near the end of Ezekiel. As I've said several times, this has been the most difficult book that I have written a commentary for. I feel like a rest from that sometimes, so have begun some work on church history as well." He wrote in February of 2010, "Lately, I have found it difficult to work as many hours as I would like, and so have decided that when the present work is completed, I won't undertake any more. I enjoy working on the commentaries and will continue to do so, but at my own pace, without the pressure of feeling I must work to deadlines. I expect to finish the present work within the next couple of months and will let you know when it is completed, in case some of you feel you need to stop support at that time." A big adjustment for Foy and Margaret came in early 2010 when they moved from the house they lived in for almost 15 years into a small apartment in their daughter Kay's basement. Ellen wrote, "Mom and Dad have moved into the basement apartment at Kay's this last weekend, so now we are working on getting the last things sorted and sold or given away. It's a hard time, especially for Mom, to move from her own house into this teeny apartment. Dad seems too tired most of the time for it to really bother him. When I asked him about seeing all his books go, he said he felt more relief than sadness." After visiting a congregation in the Houston area in 2008, Sewell Hall told his son Gardner that he was able to visit Foy's old friend Ray Votaw, who was in declining health. Votaw, like Foy, was one of Hall's heroes and had dedicated his life to establishing autonomous congregations in South Africa. He remarked that very few of the disciples in the Houston area seemed to realize what a spiritual giant they had among them or knew anything at all about Votaw's outstanding work in Africa. Such anonymity was understandable. Votaw's field of work was far from where he had to spend his last years in southeastern Texas. A few more brethren in the Nashville area may have known about Foy Short's presence among them in his declining years, but most probably didn't. Neither he nor Votaw sought recognition. As their bodies wear out, however, their spirits can be refreshed by knowing that God has used them to change thousands of lives through the good news about Jesus Christ. One evening, during one of his later trips to Zimbabwe, Foy enjoyed a quiet conversation with his friend David Novu. Foy said of Novu, "His name means elephant. He's not big, but he did the work of an elephant. He was responsible for starting at least 8 or 10 churches around the area where he lived." As they talked, Novu said that he wished that he and Foy could cross the Jordan together at the end of their lives. Foy said, "I don't know of anyone I would rather cross Jordan with than you." In relating the story in 2006, Foy remarked, "However, he, that is Novu, passed away about 3 years ago, so he's already crossed Jordan." However, as Foy enters his 90s and his body battles the infirmities of old age, the time must certainly be approaching for him to cross the river. On the other side, he will join so many that he is known in working for God's kingdom in America and Southern Africa. From his childhood, there will be the old pioneers like John Sheriff, Peter Masilla, Kamboli Matamapatenga, and George Scott. From his youth, there will be Jack Rollins, Irving Lee, and especially his closest friend, Benny Lee Fudge. From his more mature years, Jeffrey Nyembezi, David Lovu, Telly Moyo, and others will be waiting for him. Only God knows the future for Zimbabwe and other parts of Southern Africa, and whether there will be more political turmoil, famine, and social upheaval, or peace and recovery. Perhaps Christ will return and end history as we know it. But whatever the future holds for earthly kingdoms, the faithful can give thanks for the thousands who have become a part of the kingdom which cannot be shaken and whose lives have been forever changed by the influence of this quiet, unassuming, yet determined man named Foy Short. End of the main story. There will be two appendices. Appendix 1, A Brief History of Zimbabwe. To understand Foy Short's work, it's helpful to know something about Zimbabwe, the place of his labor. The country is located in southern Africa, just northeast of South Africa, east of Namibia, and south of Zambia, originally northern Rhodesia. Historically, it has had more ties with its neighbor to the south, South Africa, than with its other neighbors. Zimbabwe is not a land of jungles, but is predominantly savanna, tropical grassland. The only true forest are the evergreen forest on the eastern border and the savanna woodlands north of Bulawayo. Zimbabwe's modern history began when Bantu-speaking peoples arrived from the north and populated most of the country by about 1000 AD. They developed an advanced civilization. They built a site called Great Zimbabwe, whose stone ruins date from the 12th century and can still be seen today. This settlement grew into the trading capital of the wealthiest and most powerful society in southeastern Africa. It was considered the birthplace of the Shona culture, which prevails in northern and eastern Zimbabwe today. The Portuguese were the first Europeans to arrive in Zimbabwe in the 1500s. They encountered a weakening and fragmenting Shona presence. In 1834, the Amandebele, an offshoot of the Zulu nation of South Africa, assassinated the Shona leader of the Rozwi state and established a strong presence in the country, especially in the southwest around their newly formed capital of Bulawayo. This would be the tribe with which Foy Short would work primarily in his later years. Short learned their language, Isindebele, and found that he could use it to communicate with relative ease with his Zulu-speaking brethren in South Africa. The English began to exert their power in the late 1800s. Cecil Rhodes, a gold seeker and explorer in South Africa, set up the British South Africa Company. He signed a treaty with the Notabele King Lobengula, allowing him to mine for gold and diamonds. Rhodes planned to carve a corridor of civilization from the Southern Cape to Cairo. The first armed conflict between the English and the Africans was in 1893 with the Amandebele. Though much fewer in number, they were a warrior people descended from the Zulus, while the Shona were a pastoral, much more peaceful group. The English had been allowed by Nobungula to explore for gold in the Shona areas and were horrified when Amandebele raiders came in and killed their Shona neighbors and workers. After defeating the Amandebele in 1893, the English took control of all of Rhodesia. In 1896 came what was known by whites as the Native Rebellion and by blacks as the First Chimurenga War, the War of Independence. Both Amandebele and Shona people fought the whites, and there were atrocities committed by both sides. According to the Embassy of Zimbabwe, the uprising was suppressed by the use of unparalleled brutality and torture of the prisoners of war and civilians. The country was called Rhodesia in 1905 and became a British colony in 1923. After a brief and unsuccessful effort to combine southern Rhodesia, northern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland in a federation in 1953, the latter two countries eventually broke away and became Zambia and Malawi. During the period of European control, native Africans were kept from owning the best lands and holding positions of power. Many were illiterate or barely literate, but missionaries worked hard to change that, teaching them to read the Bible. White Europeans often resented such efforts. Eldred Eccles, a companion of Foy Short's, who preached extensively in southern Africa in the latter half of the 20th century, wrote, quote, "Some of the white settlers were very prejudiced against the educational work done by missionary groups, fearing the political awareness that would inevitably follow the ability to read newspapers and periodicals. Consequently, they were inclined to blame the missionaries when a black employee behaved irresponsibly or dishonestly, sniffing, 'After all, he was a mission boy.'" Close quote. By 1963, Great Britain began to press for more drastic changes, and many Rhodesians of European ancestry resented it. Subsequently, Ian Smith led a move for independence from Great Britain that was declared on November the 11th, 1965. He and his minority government were able to survive until 1976, when the withdrawal of South African support signaled the beginning of the end for white European rule. During this time, Shona guerrilla forces trained in China and led by Robert Mugabe, and Russian-trained Natabele forces led by Joshua Nkomo fought the Smith regime and each other. Africans who recognized the need for change, but not through the differing Marxist ideologies offered by the guerrillas, suffered greatly during this Bush War. It also greatly affected Foy Short. Finally, the Smith government conceded interim power to a moderate African leader, elections were held, and Robert Mugabe was the landslide victor. The country's name was changed to Zimbabwe. Mugabe's rule in Zimbabwe, along with a series of droughts, has ruined Zimbabwe's economy and brought on famine and hardship. Once heralded as a champion of the anti-colonial movement, Mugabe is now viewed by much of the international community as an authoritarian ruler responsible for egregious human rights abuses and for ruining the economy of his country into the ground. Margaret Short recalled hearing many Amandabeli and even some Shona express longing for the stability they enjoyed under the British and even the Ian Smith government. She recalled, quote, "A large crowd gathered outside the department store when they heard that Ian Smith was there. His security people urged him to leave by the back door. He replied that no way would he go out that way, but he would go out by the way he'd come in. When he appeared, there was loud cheering." Close quotes. The precipitous fall of the economy in Zimbabwe and the repressive instability of Mugabe's government led to the flight of most inhabitants of European ancestry and many of African descent from the country. Paddy Kendall said that it was estimated in 2008 that 3 million people had left the country because of the political and economic problems. 1 million Zimbabweans lived in South Africa. Christianity in Zimbabwe. The Portuguese Jesuit Gonçalo da Silveira initiated the first European religious contact with the Shona in 1561. Further efforts followed in the 1600s, but no permanent Catholic presidents resulted until 1879. Since then, there's been substantial growth. The first Protestant missionary to Zimbabwe was Robert Moffat, who opened a London Missionary Society station in Inyate in 1859. The British Methodist and the United Methodist arrived in 1890. The former has a large white constituency, while the latter is mostly African. The Salvation Army, which entered in 1891, has the largest single Protestant community, is predominantly Shona, and is rapidly increasing in size. Foy admired the early missionaries to Southern Africa, though he did not agree with their doctrine. He wrote in the 1950s, quote, "A Catholic missionary was the first to be martyred for his faith. He was skinned alive and left to die in agony. The order of the civilizing process was, first and always first, the missionary, then the trader, then the empire builder who brought with him the colonists and settlers." The admirable sacrifices of early missionaries from mainstream denominations sometimes made Foy's teaching efforts difficult. He wrote, quote, "One old man said to me, 'Teacher Short, it's clear from your words and the words of the Bible that my church is wrong, but those first missionaries saw the wickedness and wretchedness of my people and came to us more than 60 years ago. By their coming, they did not gain any wealth, but many of them lost their lives. They loved me and my people. They gave themselves to help us. It cannot be right for us now to turn against them. Why did not your missionaries of the Church of Christ come to us before today? Brethren, what answer would you have given that man?" Close quote, and end of appendix number one. And now, appendix number two, a brief sketch of early American evangelists in northern and southern Rhodesia. Dow and Alice Merritt. Merritt, like Will and Delia Short, studied at Cordell Christian College. After 2 years there, he joined the Navy in 1913 and became a medic. He married Alice from Odessa, Texas, after leaving the Navy. He moved to Africa in July of 1926 and spent most of the rest of his life there. After Alice tragically died of cancer, he married Helen Pearl Scott, George and Otis Scott's daughter, on May 14, 1942. Foy's sister, Sybil, said of the Merritts, "We love them dearly." Dow's son, Roy, was in charge of the Namuyanga mission through the 1990s, and when Foy's daughter Ellen visited Zambia in 1995, he gave her a tour of the grounds that she had known as a child. Another son, Sterling, lived close to Ellen in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and maintains contact with her. George and Otis Scott. The Scotts were highly respected Christians on the West Coast in the early 1900s. W.N. Short's paper, Glimpses of Africa, carried a biographical sketch of Scott and his family written by Leonard Gray. According to Gray, Scott was born in Kansas December 19, 1874, and moved with his parents in 1884 to the state of Washington. His father passed away when he was 14 years old, and young George had to struggle to survive working in logging camps, fruit camps, and among fishermen. Otis's grandfather attended Alexander Campbell's Bethany College. She married George's brother, Roy D., who tragically passed away in 1909. After becoming a Christian at 16 years of age, George preached to, quote, Indians in Alaska, Japanese in California, and anyone who would listen, close quote. He married Otis in 1914 and began to work with her to teach others on the West Coast, making their living through various pursuits. The online history of the Pacific Christian Academy quotes a description of the school given by Otis Scott, who was the only full-time teacher when that school began in 1918. Eldred Eccles wrote about Scott, quote, George Scott was in his mid-50s when the pull of Afra became a fire in his bones that could not be quenched. He had been engaged in salmon fishing in Alaska, but his boat blew up and he was seriously burned. As he lay recuperating in a hospital, he had time to reflect on the priorities in his life, and then and there resolved to give up fishing for salmon and become a fisher of men. He wired his wife and daughter, who were living on the American West Coast, to pack up and get ready to leave for Africa. Close quotes. The Scots, who arrived in Africa in 1927, took care of a number of orphans throughout their lives. They believed in partaking the Lord's Supper with only one container, but worked with those who believed in individual cups by partaking of one cup with each other when the communion tray was passed around. The Scots worked in Africa for 30 years and only returned once to America after leaving it. Perhaps Scott was Foy's favorite among the early evangelists who worked with his father in Africa. He fondly recalled a visit with the Scots in Cape Town in 1954, just before George's death in January of 1955. Otis Scott died in December of the same year. DeWitt and Dolly Garrett. The S.D. Garretts worked first with the Shorts in Wuyu Wuyu before moving to Salisbury in the early 1930s. There are many references in the Word and Work magazine to contact between the Garretts and the Shorts in the mid-1930s. Their children were close in age. Sybil said of the couple, "He didn't relate to kids very well. His wife was wonderful with us, and she was a role model to me." Foy said that there were problems in later years with DeWitt Garrett because he promoted his premillennial ideas. However, on one occasion in 1948, Foy appreciated Garrett's spirited defense of a cappella singing and worship with the Colin Brander congregation in Bulawayo. He wrote Benny Lee Fudge, "Brother Garrett proved to be a first-line stalwart throughout this meeting and his stand for New Testament practices." W.L. and Addie Brown. The Leslie Brown family arrived in Africa when the Shorts were in America in 1930. Eldred Eccles described Leslie as, quote, "harsh and peremptory," unquote, in his treatment of the native blacks. Foy and Sybil confirmed that he had a headstrong personality, though Foy said he was a genius at organizing and getting things done. Foy had a much higher personal regard for Brown's son, Robert. A.B., that is Alva, Reese. Reese was born in 1888 in Carthage, Missouri, and married Margaret Langford in 1918. He was encouraged by O.W. Gardner, J.L. Armstrong, L.O. Sanderson, and Don Carlos Janes to move to Africa. His sister was Otis Scott. After arriving in Africa in 1929, the Reeses worked for 3 years at Sinde Mission with the Scots, then stayed 5 more years after the Scots left. They never received more than $25 a month during the first years of their stay in Africa, but Reese, who was a capable woodworker, supplemented the family income by raising their food and making furniture and wagons. Their son Boyd traveled to Nigeria in 1950 with Eldred Eccles, and they became the first Americans to contact the churches there that had been established by C.A.O. Essien. The Reeses returned to the States after 25 years in Zambia. Margaret and A.B. passed away in 1972 and 1974, respectively, in Arkansas. Alvin and Georgia Hobby. Alvin was from Estella, Tennessee, near Lewisburg. He studied at David Lipscomb and Harding College. He met Georgia at Harding, and Dalmerit convinced them to go to Africa. They reached Africa in 1938 and worked primarily at Namuyanga Mission until returning to the States in 1982. Myrtle Rowe. She was a 42-year-old widow when she first arrived at Namuyanga Mission, quote, at 3 p.m. Saturday, September the 10th, 1938, close quote. She lived at Northern Rhodesia, or Zambia, for almost 20 years, working primarily at Namuyanga Mission. Margaret Short loved Myrtle Rowe. Margaret recalled how she took her under her wing when she arrived at Namuyanga in 1947. Orville Britell. Orville's parents, especially his resolute mother Augusta, were very interested in mission work and encouraged him to go to Africa in the 1940s along with his wife, whose name was also Augusta. Orville, whom Foy and Margaret respected and loved, worked with them at Namuyanga Mission in the latter 1940s and accompanied Foy on his second preaching expedition into the Zambezi River escarpment. He was mechanically inclined and rigged up an old truck to run on steam so that it could carry the evangelist's supplies into the previously unexplored area. He gave Foy and Margaret their first motorized transportation, a heavily modified motorcycle that they used when they first moved to Bulawayo. After Orville went to Africa, his parents, who were originally from Missouri but also lived in California, sold everything they had and moved there, working particularly with orphans in the area around Sinde Mission near Livingston. When Orville's mother, Augusta, passed away in the 1960s, most of the family, including Orville, returned to the States. His sister Elaine stayed at Sinde Mission until she was murdered in the 1970s. 6,000 people attended her funeral. After returning from Africa, Orville lived in southeastern Pennsylvania, working some at Northeastern Christian College while it was in operation. He passed away in 2007. J.C. and Joyce Copeland Shoemaker. J.C., also called Jimmy, was from Paragould, Arkansas, and studied at David Lipscomb College, where he heard John Sheriff talk about the work in Southern Africa. He met Joyce when leading singing at her home congregation. They both became educators in Arkansas until Dalmerit and A.B. Reist convinced them to go to Southern Africa in the late 1930s. They arrived too late to be much of an influence on Foy, but were highly respected for their work in northern Rhodesia before moving to Bulawayo in late 1967. They returned to the States permanently in 1977, living in Searcy, Arkansas, where J.C. died in 1985, and Joyce in 1987. End of the appendices and end of the recording of this book.